don't need to wish upon a star to make your dreams of exceptional coffee come true. You just need to go to sparkplugcoffee.com. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica fair trade beans. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf, half-calf, and a rotating seasonal blend. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this splendid coffee to your home or office within 1 week of custom roasting it here in Toronto, so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor. And you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug as you need it, or join the Sparkplug Autopilot Coffee Club. The Autopilot Coffee Club is not a coffee of the month club. It's got no strings to hold you down. It's completely personalized and flexible, and it comes with all kinds of member benefits. If you're one of our American listeners, the wait is over. No longer are us Canadians hogging all the Sparkplug. It now delivers in Canada and the US. And if you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, and that's all one word with the number 100, Sparkplug is offering 20% off your next coffee order. That applies to any size order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100 Project
and action.
Happy March, film fans, and thank you forever and ever for downloading the next 185 Project. We got our podcasting start nearly 7 years ago by reviewing the 123 films honored by the AFI on their 1998 and 2007 Top 100 lists. Now we dig deep into whatever movie tickles our curiosity bone. And we won't fib to you, we spoil. I'm the cheerfully dim Pleasure Island visitor who would shoot pool all day long if he could, Ryan Ellis. And here's my charming conscience who breaks into old Italian men's houses, my award-nominated wife, Bev.
That's me.
Some of those things will become evident as the podcast goes on, and some will be inside jokes we'll probably tell you about as we go on in the next couple of weeks and months. He does break into the old man's house, though, doesn't he? He may be a cricket, but...
I have plenty of thoughts about how Jiminy Cricket ended up with the moral responsibility of raising this wooden child.
May not be a villain, but shades of that in some ways. That's also part of my nutshell. Anyway, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, the 80-year-old Pinocchio. Pinocchio is on AFI's Top 100 Cheers list. How many cartoons ranked higher than Pinocchio, and how many other animated picks were on the list at all?
I didn't spot another single animated movie.
Which surprised me. It's 38th on the Cheers list. There's nothing higher because there's no other cartoons.
If you wanted to be flexible, you could say that Babe.
I noticed that. Not
it's
animated,
cartoony,
though.
But no, it's special effects. Live action. Yeah.
It's live action with special effects.
Yeah.
But no other bona fide animated films. I was surprised. I wouldn't have thought necessarily Snow White would be on there, but you think some other animated
Maybe Toy
picture.
Story. Toy Story, I say. Lick.
Toy Story. But just Pinocchio, and there are a lot of lessons to be learned. I didn't read Roger Ebert's review before we prepped for this, but I remember reading years ago, he talked about how when, I think maybe his grandkids would see it, the scene where the nose grows, the way that their eyes would bulge, almost like, oh man, I better not lie. So they're learning lessons, which is probably one of the big reasons why that made the most inspiring list. All right, well, we'll get into that in a few minutes, but first let's set it up. Old Block of Wood was released by RKO and, of course, Walt Disney on February 23rd, 1940. After many successful re-releases, we have evidence that the numbers don't lie. This was a gigantic hit. And that's good because it went way over budget back in 1940. In fact, it is the 45th most successful motion picture ever when adjusted for inflation. But a lot of animated films are on the shortlist for that. Snow White, of course. 101 Dalmatians is way up there. Yeah. As is Bambi, I believe.
It's going to have an advantage when it came out before there was even television and you have a kid's movie. Adjusted for inflation is essentially saying which movie sold the most tickets.
Yes.
And kids can just watch movies over and over and over and over again. And when you take away any kind of home media options, then, yeah, they probably, with each re-release, which it was re-released every 7 to 10 years. Yeah, yeah. Because it didn't actually make a fortune in its first release. It was just over the decades of coming back to theaters, kids watch it, and then whole new generations of kids watching it.
Well, Bev, this movie is 80 years old, so remind people what it's about. With the 80-year-old woodmaker named Geppetto, and you're skinny. He's not 80, but anyway.
days old, in response to a lonely woodcarver named Geppetto making a wish upon a star, a blue fairy uses her godlike powers to give sentience to a wooden puppet named Pinocchio, whom she immediately instructs to behave himself or be a puppet forever. And this isn't even the third weirdest thing to happen in this children's cautionary tale in which Pinocchio is repeatedly kidnapped, sold, rescued, and swallowed by a whale, all in the interest of upgrading to a corporeal body, which, I gotta tell you, Pinocchio, comes with its drawbacks.
That's true. Wouldn't be so bad to be a puppet. Or, in a nutshell, a bug provides insufficient counsel to a tree. Jiminy Cricket,
I like that one.
Jiminy Cricket is a terrible conscience. And at the end, he's given a badge as if he's this great conscience, when he's not. And it really isn't his fault entirely. Pinocchio makes his own decisions, but Jiminy Cricket gives
up... Pinocchio's his own man.
His own... Not even a man yet, not even a boy.
He's been alive for hours. He should be able to make his own decisions.
Jiminy gives up so quickly and so easily, it takes nothing to discourage him. All right, let me set this up, and then we'll get into the point that I know you want to make, which is about that exact thing. A lot of numbers first, though. Rotten Tomatoes, 100%. I haven't said this in a long time, I don't think. Of critics like this movie, 51 fresh, 0 rotten. For an average of 9.1 out of 10, but only 73% of audiences. If anything, I would have thought it'd be the audiences were over the moon for it, and the critics were just good about it, but it's the other way around. It won 2 Oscars in 1940 for the song When You Wish Upon a Star, which became the music for the Disney logo, and it's in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Spielberg must love this movie, because that's a big theme in that movie. Subtext, more so, in Close Encounters. And it also won for the music score in 1940. Lee Harline, or Harlan, but it's spelled Harline, won awards for both of those, involved in the song and the music score. The film was put in the National Film Registry 5 years into their project in 1994, along with movies we've covered, The African Queen, The Apartment, E.T., The Manchurian Candidate, there's a great one, Midnight Cowboy, Taxi Driver, also a great one, and those are all AFI films, along with movies we've covered since, Invasion of the Body Snatchers and The Lady Eve. What a great year 1994 was for the National Film Registry. In addition to making the top 100 Cheers, it was 7th in the top 100 songs with When You Wish Upon a Star. Over the Rainbow was number 1, the song from Wizard of Oz, and 2nd on the top 100 genres was Pinocchio. In the animation category, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs was not surprisingly number 1. It was also nominated for the top 100 Thrills, which is probably mostly for the whale stuff at the end, the top 50 Villains, Stromboli, who's barely in this movie, the top 25 Musicals, the top 100 Quotes with A Lie Keeps Growing Until It's Plain as the Nose in Your Face, which is not really a quote anyone quotes, but...
So, musicals, does it have more than 3 songs?
I guess that's enough for them.
There you go.
Debatable, isn't it? And also the 1998 AFI Top 100. All right, then. So, Pinocchio, which I think you've seen before, right? I'm a big fan. I picked this movie. But what are your thoughts on the little Italian puppet?
I definitely saw this when I was a kid. And it is so much weirder than I remember. I'm still trying to sort out just what morality they're trying to impose on the children viewing it.
Don't lie.
Like, don't lie. Don't trust adults. Truancy is definitely punished pretty severely here. As you already said, Jiminy Cricket isn't as helpful as you think he might be. And it's also way darker than I remember. There's all this stuff that's really charming and cute, and then suddenly children are being permanently changed into donkeys and sold to salt mines. What the hell, Disney? But credit for making a film that was very visually innovative and still looks outstandingly beautiful today.
Yeah, we saw the Blu-ray that I've owned for a long time. Lovely print, I think. They did a painstaking job of restoring it many years ago. I think even for the DVD, maybe, but certainly for the Blu-ray. And it's, of course, 1:37, the old Academy ratio. We haven't watched that many movies from this long ago in a while. I mentioned The Lady Eve, which we covered a couple of years ago. We haven't covered that many movies, though, from way back of that era. We should do more of them, I guess. Anyway, the morality stuff. Well, let's talk about Jiminy Cricket, because he is the first character we see. He breaks into Geppetto's house and then is given the job of being the conscience by the Blue Fairy. Maybe she doesn't know better, and maybe she knows exactly what's going to happen. Maybe she knows that Pinocchio has to go through this adventure, and he can't have somebody who actually stops him from going through the adventure, because Jiminy just says, well, I guess he knows enough to be on his own more than once. I do like the way he's voiced by Cliff Edwards, just like Dickie Jones, who is the page in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, the kid. You see him a few times in Mr. Smith with Jimmy Stewart, and at the end it's the, okay, when Jimmy Stewart has passed out. He never did any other voiceover work I could see, and he died in 2014. He was 87 years old. But those are two big titles. That's a career for anybody, to be a Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, which you didn't like. That came out the year before this, and then to be the voice in Pinocchio. But Cliff Edwards, who was in Gone with the Wind, of course, on screen, not as a voiceover, and his girl Friday, the same year as this, did 75 movies in nearly 40 years. And, of course, when you talk about him being the conscience, his initials are J.C. But I think the actual J.C. is so much more qualified to counsel people.
Why does Jiminy Cricket get tasked with being Pinocchio's conscience? His only qualification is that he was nearby and awake when it happened.
Should have been one of those alarm clocks.
It should have been Geppetto. Geppetto was the one who requested a sentient puppet in the first place. One would think that he would be given the responsibility of making sure it didn't become evil. But no, this homeless talking insect will do, because he's nearby. Everyone in this film is just terrible at what they do. Starting with Geppetto, good lord.
The Blue Fairy's a lot like the Good Witch from Wizard of Oz the year before this, one of the great children's films of all time, I guess, which is also weird and dark a lot of the time and has a lot of thrills in it. And she also withholds information, doesn't really do her job properly. Of course, the legendary thing there is you could just told Dorothy from the beginning to click her heels, but then she needs to have the adventure. I really do think that maybe that's part of what's going on here. Why Jiminy is the choice for it is because he's not going to be good at it, because Pinocchio needs to learn these lessons.
Okay, there is a vocal group on the internet that believes that the Good Witch is the actual villain of The Wizard of Oz, and the Blue Fairy is the villain of Pinocchio. She grants life with godlike powers, but with caveats. This is just the first part of her sick game. So she has the power to create life, but not the power to say, oh, I don't know, tell Geppetto what happened to Pinocchio, or tell Pinocchio how to get to school. That would be helpful so that Pinocchio wouldn't get lost, or that Geppetto, who honestly could not be more ill-equipped to raise a child, gets himself eaten by a whale. And the Blue Fairy sends a message to Pinocchio telling him what happened to Geppetto, which she could have done with Geppetto to just help Pinocchio at any time. Maybe even in time to save the dozens of other children who were not so lucky at Pleasure Island. But instead, she lets Geppetto get eaten by a whale so that a 36-hour-old guileless Pinocchio could die saving him. Because he actually does die. He washes up on the rocks. They cannot resuscitate him. Geppetto brings him home, and they're like, what a bummer. I really did like having a child, but oh well. And then she comes back and she revives him, but this time he is a real boy.
There's talk about how Pinocchio drowned there, and that's inconsistent because we see him walking underwater and talking underwater, but because he's not real, he doesn't need to breathe, and that's a real advantage. But I think what it is, and I read this online, when he is dead, before he's brought back to life at the very end, is he got bashed against the rocks. Now, if he's wooden, does that really matter? But you could make that argument that he didn't drown, he was just bashed to death.
Everything that happens to him is the whim of this cruel deity,
she appears three times, I can remember. She creates Pinocchio, well, then again, Geppetto created him, but she makes him sentient, and then she lets him out of the cage when his nose is growing because he's been lying, when he's in a cage with Stromboli, where he's going to be a slave for the rest of his life, as far as he knows at the time, and then she makes him a real boy at the end. Which I think is also true, or similar enough, anyway, to the Good Witch in Wizard of Oz, right? She meets Dorothy in Munchkinland. She saves all of them when they've been knocked out by the Wicked Witch of the West. When they're close to Emerald City, the poppy sequence, the drug sequence, if you will. And then at the end, you've had the power to go home all along.
I think maybe why it genuinely does bother me a little more with Pinocchio than it does with Wizard of Oz is that Wizard of Oz is an adventure film where the whole point is that Dorothy has to grow, whereas Pinocchio is very blatantly a morality tale that's meant to instruct children on how to behave, but the standards by which it wants children to behave are spurious.
Especially considering he is, even if he was a real boy, so young. You mentioned about going to school. Well, that's always been one of my favorite things about this. That he's only hours old, and Geppetto is saying, okay, go off to school, but how can he even get there? I guess you could argue he knows where to go. He's been given directions, but he's not registered. Go with him, Geppetto. You got to sign him up, introduce him to the principal and all that stuff.
I know, Geppetto, are you so busy that you can't just walk this child to school? What's wrong with you? Good Lord, what was the Blue Fairy thinking, giving a child to this man who just over and over screws it up?
He might be really senile. And why is he in the middle of the ocean getting into a whale's belly in the first place, which is probably a Jonah reference from the Bible. But why is he in the ocean looking for a puppet? Why would Pinocchio be there? Then again, he is on Pleasure Island, but I don't think Geppetto knows that.
Geppetto doesn't know much.
It's not like Pleasure Island is where Geppetto was anyway. But well, when the story starts, Jiminy Cricket actually opens the book of Pinocchio to start the story. And, of course, the book was by Carlo Collodi. 1883 is when he wrote it. And there are a lot of story adaptation credits on the IMDb. It looks like 9 people were involved in writing this screenplay. A lot of supervising directors as well. There's no one director. Ben Sharpstein was the one you technically got credit for Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs as a director. And I guess you could say the same about this movie, but of course it's Disney's movie as the producer. But because Jiminy opens up the book of Pinocchio, it makes me wonder, is this supposed to just be that this is a story and none of what you are about to watch, even in this world, really happened? I guess it did, but whenever somebody has that, here's a story, let me turn the pages for you, makes you think, but is it really real? But even in their world, never mind real.
When he starts the story, he starts by talking about his own experience, so maybe it's implied that he wrote the book or that the book was written about what he dictated to somebody.
Well, he's not really with Pinocchio very often, so he's got time to write. He does bail on him constantly.
In the book, Pinocchio is a real jerk. When he is brought to life, he actually is bad, and he needs to learn to be good through torture. So this was like a book about corporal punishment. In the book, Jiminy Cricket is a much smaller part. He's a minor character. He's a cricket that Pinocchio kills with a mallet right. And then is later haunted by as a ghost. Then they decided when they made the film to tame Pinocchio down quite a bit and make him instead completely innocent and guileless, and then turn Jiminy into the moral compass, who's the world-weary wise one trying to keep him out of trouble poorly, as we've mentioned before.
There are great details in this, and of course the animation is outstanding, as it was so often back then for Disney, because this is the same era as Bambi, which I'm not a big fan of, Dumbo, around the same time. Fantasia was the same year as this. That made the AFI's list, and I would sooner have seen this movie make that list than Fantasia.
Disagree.
Okay. But there are some great details to the whole film, especially early on, though. Jiminy Cricket's shadow in front of the fire like that, that's a touch that would take an awful lot of planning and preparation. And just attention to detail. Figaro, the cat, who was Disney's favorite character in the whole thing, apparently. He really loved the cat. His envy of Pinocchio, but also his tiredness. He can't stay awake. So, kind of fox-like.
I'm so mad, but also pretty tired.
So tired.
And also the violent clocks that Geppetto crafts.
Oh my god. I remember as a kid really loving this sequence where Geppetto has designed all of these wooden clocks that have elaborate, what's the word, like animatronic mechanisms that they go through when they turn a time, whatever, midnight or something.
He must never sleep.
I know, so
not consistently.
But every single one of those animatronics is portraying something violent and awful, like a little boy getting spanked or...
Ow!
Yeah.
Ow! Or the head getting cut off of someone else.
Yes! Yes! It's terrible! And it's universally true about every single one of those clocks. Like, this is what Geppetto spends his time doing. Again, Blue Fairy, you're gonna give him a child?
Well, that leads me into what happens next when the story is over and everyone's so happy at the end. I think Geppetto has to come up with a creative lie to the world, in that little town in Italy, at least where he lives, about where Pinocchio really came from, this real boy now, and why no one ever saw him in school before. Especially since people in that neighborhood must have known Geppetto lived alone for a very long time, probably, and has presumably lived in that very house for a long time. Maybe he was married with his own family and something bad happened to them. The movie doesn't say that at all. I'm completely speculating, but how would he have explained where the puppet came from? He's clearly a puppet going to school. He never gets there.
It is fun to imagine Child Protective Services showing up at Geppetto's house and dragging Pinocchio away, kicking and screaming. I guess this is a world full of magic. You have a talking fox and a talking cat, and you have a amusement park that turns little boys into donkeys, and Pinocchio just kind of walks around with his wooden limbs. People are like, wow, look at that! A sentient puppet! And they maybe think about how they can exploit him, but beyond that, he doesn't seem to really spark that much interest in people, even though there's nothing about him that remotely hides the fact that he is made of wood. So I guess we're just talking about a more magical world where a senile old man might acquire a boy in a totally non-suspicious way in a town where we have to presume a lot of boys have gone missing lately because we know that Pleasure Island has turned dozens of them into donkeys.
Yeah, that might be some subtext for what's happened in the world. Child labor. There were no child labor laws back in the era the movie was even made, I don't think, 1940, and certainly not back in 1883 when the book was written.
I saw a great theory about this, which was that I keep criticizing the morality of the film and just what exactly it's trying to say about what makes a creature, a puppet, or a boy righteous. It seems less designed to encourage compassion or generosity, but more to keep kids in line. It's more of an assimilation fable than it is a morality fable. Because other than lying, the sins that kids get punished for are more the sins of rebellion, like truancy or smoking or, God forfend, playing billiards. They're not bad people, they're just rebellious kids. And then I saw this theory that it's not even just that they're rebellious, it's that the indulgences that Lampwick and the other doomed boys are punished for are the indulgences of the working class. They blow off school, they play pool, they're drinking and smoking, they're committing vandalism. And the metaphor is apt then that these indulgences would turn you into a beast of burden. And so this is a morality play, it's an assimilation play, but it's also kind of a message about the superiority of the values of the middle class as much as it is those other two things. It's a piece of propaganda, kids.
Right. Or also, if you're talented enough to be an actor, which Pinocchio is for what seems to be a brief time with Stromboli, but also he's a slave to that guy, that's frowned upon, I guess, too.
Yeah, he could have been a very gifted actor. Hey. Although he would have been happy to sing his songs and do his dances.
No strings to tie me down.
To make me smile, to make me frown.
And when you see this clearly non-human doing this, that would be a revolutionary show. You think they'd be, it's like in King Kong. I love the gag in The Simpsons. So, Denim, what's he going to do? Oh, he's going to stand around for a while? What a showman. At least Pinocchio does stuff. But after a while, you think, yeah, we saw the puppet guy, the person, whatever, however you look at that as an audience member. See that show once. I don't know. Do you keep on going back for it? But Stromboli thinks he's going to make a mint until the Blue Fairy saves Pinocchio and Jiminy Cricket, for that matter, getting the hell out of there. The guy who voiced Stromboli is also the voice of the coachman, who's a real villain, the one who ends up getting him to go to Pleasure Island. That's Charles Judels, I guess is his name. Not a lot of famous names in the voiceover credits, but he is two villains in one movie. And he got to be the voice of one who was nominated for the villains list, who is, like I said earlier, barely in this film.
While this movie is supposed to be a morality story, the people who are truly evil, the actually sinister adults, never get punished. Stromboli, the fox, and the cat.
Fox!
The coachman. They all get away scot-free.
And then Geppetto is the absentee dad. He's a bad dad.
Where's Pinocchio? Maybe I'll check the middle of the ocean.
I talked about nice touches in the animation. Of course, this is a well-animated film. I like how they rotoscoped the Blue Fairy, as they did with the prince in Snow White. So it's a real person, and they just drew over that person. It's funny, in this era, Snow White, Pinocchio, two of the first movies that Walt ever did for feature-length, well, Snow White was the first he ever did for a feature-length animation film, where more than just one character doesn't seem animated in the way that we know now. Where it'd be hard to argue that, hey, they just drew over a real person. It seems like it's more than just the Blue Fairy and the prince, as far as I'm concerned. It almost seems like Snow White herself sometimes. And maybe she was, I don't recall. We covered that so many years ago. It was the same thing, where they rotoscoped. Not Pinocchio in this movie, clearly. Not Jiminy Cricket. But other characters, I don't know, it just feels like they might have done the same thing.
They did a process. It was half rotoscope, where they used actors performing the parts to act as models to inspire the drawings. But then they did the animation thing where they would exaggerate everything a little bit so that it looked more cartoonish, with the exception of the Blue Fairy. In many ways, the Blue Fairy looks different than everything else in the movie because she's supposed to stand apart. So she has this abstracted, minimalist face, she's painted in watercolors, like you said, she's rotoscoped, and it's all to set her apart. I think it's quite effective because she's ethereal, she's lovely, but she doesn't quite take the same kind of form that all the other characters in the film take.
I'm coming up with a theory right now, and of course the movie I'm about to mention came after Pinocchio, but just like Clarence and It's Wonderful Life, maybe the Blue Fairy is one of the lamos of the fairies. Maybe she's the weak link. Clarence stumbles upon making George Bailey realize his life is worth living, because he's not a talented angel. He's been given chances before to earn his wings, but never does. So obviously he failed in other situations.
All the other fairies are laughing at the Blue Fairy.
So maybe that's why we keep criticizing the Blue Fairy. They sent the lamoid, the D student of the Blue Fairies.
Hey, why don't you animate another puppet, stupid?
Oh, I did it again! Well, thank God this one's got an awful big conscience. Not even necessarily Jiminy Cricket, but his own conscience when he goes home and realizes his dad isn't there and hasn't been for a while because there's cobwebs everywhere. It's clear that Geppetto's been gone for a long time. We just talked a minute ago about Stromboli and the Coachman and J. Worthington Fowl. That's Honest John, apparently his actual name. And you see it in the IMDb right in front of us here. So I guess it's John Worthington Fowlfellow. A lot of villains, but also the whale, who also doesn't pay for his crimes of trying to eat our heroes. But then the whale is just trying to eat.
Although everybody in the ocean is scared of him. I don't know about you, but this movie terrified me as a child.
And it should be terrifying.
Even still today, the scene, which is portrayed in shadow, it's actually really cool when Lampwick gets turned into a donkey. That child is terrified.
It's part of the lessons to be learned as well. Just like Pinocchio playing hooky for fortune and fame, because he does. He's conned into it by Honest John, and he's a kid, so he's not entirely to blame by any means.
He's a newborn.
Right.
He was born yesterday, and he's still literally.
Not even a person. But he is playing hooky for the wrong reasons, too. It's not like he's doing it for a good reason. It's not like he saw some worthy deed he had to do, and then that's why he missed school. By the way, you talked about songs. Of course, Hi Diddly D, An Actor's Life for Me. That's one of the songs. I've Got No Strings, When You Wish Upon a Star. So there are quite a few musical sequences in this film. There might be as many.
There's the three.
Well, there might be as many with those three as there are in some other quote-unquote musicals with those big ones, especially when you got a song as famous as When You Wish Upon a Star. Well, we covered Gladiator just last week, and I feel it's fair to say that Stromboli is like Proximo. He's a tough agent. But, of course, in this case, he's a true villain. Proximo's not a villain so much. Proximo had an arc of, I don't know, redemption. He wasn't really that bad a guy.
I think you're right, because they both also want to enslave their performer.
Well, and Proximo does. I guess he is not such a good guy, is he? It's just that he's more fair with Russell Crowe's character and the other ones in that movie. It's almost like, well, you're a star, so I will grant you the chance to have your freedom. I guess I'm giving him too much credit, aren't I? But Stromboli
Sympathy
is clearly a villain.
Slave
he
owner.
Slams this little wooden puppet into a cage, and that's where you'll stay the rest of your life, and you'll perform, and if you don't, then you'll be turned into kindling. And we talked about how Pinocchio doesn't need to breathe underwater, and that's a real advantage when he's trying to find Geppetto walking along underneath. That sequence is a little surreal, too, but anyway, it's kind of fun, I guess. So why would cigarette smoke make him green if he's not a real boy? It looks cute when that's animated that way, and that's probably why they did it. Remind me a little bit of Dopey, some of the times the way they animate him, especially in that moment. But he's smoking cigars, drinking beer, playing poker and pool. All those things are supposed to be so immoral. I guess the cigars and beer for a kid are immoral, and he shouldn't be doing that. But then there's no one to watch over him. It's not his fault. He doesn't know, and he's the most innocent creature on the planet at this point. But why does he turn green? I guess just because the movie wants him to.
This is really straining my suspension of disbelief.
It's interesting, too, that Pinocchio and Lampwick didn't notice the others turn into donkeys before they themselves started turning into donkeys. It didn't just happen with them. There are a lot of other ones because, of course, that's why Jiminy comes across them, I think. He's the one that discovers that, oh, my God, I got to get Pinocchio out of here for sure now.
Yeah, it's Jiminy that successfully rescues him. And for the record, as morality goes, Pinocchio just leaving Lampwick and all the other boys behind, not the bravest thing he could have done, but I think the movie is implying that those boys actually deserve what they got.
Got what they had coming.
How dare you play pool? A life of servitude for you.
And also be conned into it by an adult. Well, when he becomes a talking donkey, I guess they all do, but especially, well, because Pinocchio doesn't really become a full-on donkey, he's got the ears and the tail. There was money when he was a puppet. Now there's a lot of money in the entertainment field if he just stayed as a puppet with those ears and that tail. He's such a freak show. Like the Elephant Man. I am not a man. I am a puppet with ears. I am not a human being at all. We talked about Monster of the Whale a minute ago, and of course that is the big climax at the end, and that is where things get really over the top big in that moment and loud and everything else. He's a sneezy whale because, of course, they light the fire to make him sneeze them out. I can see why kids would be a little terrified by that.
I recall being spooked by the whale. But it's like cool sequence. I feel like I'm dumping on this movie a lot, but I do have to give it credit for what is a really elevated level of creativity. They create this world that's believable and consistent, where there's just magic everywhere, and it's a kind of a kid's brain that, of course, whales are hollow. Don't you imagine that inside the whale is not only hollow, but it's big enough to fit a capsized ship? And that people could live there.
A grown man with a fish in a bowl and a cat. And then
lamenting,
a puppet.
Oh, I never thought it would end this way, Figaro. Living inside a whale.
All kinds of undigested fish that they can fish for and eat. And then light a fire and get their way out of there. Well, another bad guy in the movie, in a way, is the actor who voiced Geppetto. And that was Christian Rubb. And the reason he's a bad guy, he was a Nazi sympathizer. And of course, this is around the time the Nazis were really starting to take over Europe. They made Geppetto look like the actual actor. And if you look online at Christian Rubb, you'll see what I'm talking about. He did 113 movies. And in the end, he's not in the movie that much, but he's fine with the voice. The guy that I found to be a bit of a cliche, because I've talked about this before, in this era, young kids who are in movies so often do that, hey, tough guy kind of voice. Well, Frankie Darrow does that when he plays Lampwick. And he's working way too hard to be just like them. But then they all did that back then. So
and it's cartoonish, so it works that it's cartoonish. And also for all of the grief that I'm giving Geppetto, he does just fill me with great, warm dad vibes. He's so sweet. It totally wins you over. He's so thrilled when Pinocchio comes to life, and he loves him immediately. And of course, he's kind to his pets, so I love that, too.
I really think maybe he lost some family members along the way. Looking back at it now, I don't think he's been alone all this time. He's a pretty good toy maker, but he does like some really sick clocks, though. Well, Walt Disney was the producer, of course, of this film. He won 22 Oscars. I feel like there's more than that, but I see 22 online. We've covered at least three movies that he produced in the same era. Snow White and Fantasia made the top 100 list for the AFI, and now Pinocchio. Maybe there's more, but those three at least. What do you think of those three movies now in retrospect? Snow White and Fantasia were a long time ago. We covered them. But his legacy in general, and of course there are a lot of other movies he made. Not all were good. Plenty were very forgettable. But now that name is such a brand, and they own everything.
The legacy of Disney as a corporation aside, the legacy of Disney as the innovator in animation, I don't know if you could begin to measure the influence that they had, because it set the tone for all animation in the future. Who knows if someone else had the gumption to make a feature animated film, maybe animation wouldn't even be necessarily a kids genre. We might be able to just credit Disney with always and forever associating animation with children. Of course, it's not always now, and they do make animated films for adults, but why does it have to be for kids? I think that could have just been imprinted upon us by Disney. And I know he wasn't alone, not just he, but Disney Corporation and Disney artists, they weren't alone, but they were creating the best that there was, and their innovations are unmatched. Maybe you could say there's a parallel in Pixar today where they just make these outstanding films and their quality is really this unparalleled high standard. And you can tell the difference between a Pixar film and a DreamWorks film. And I'm really using this as an example because I think it's impossible for me to put myself in the 30s and the 40s and really appreciate just how innovative and new and fresh and influential these films were. So I kind of have to use that as a reference point. I can't think of another filmmaker who had a more singular influence than Walt Disney.
In Hollywood, yeah, there may not be a bigger one. And there have been a lot of animators over the years. Obviously, Miyazaki in Japan's a big one. And you mentioned Pixar, which started out not being a Disney thing. They've been a Disney thing for a while now, literally under their banner. And even when they started, well, Steve Jobs was involved, and so was Lucas in a way with Pixar. I forget exactly how now, but I know he was involved in the very beginning. And I think Disney was involved longer than we really think, but they've literally owned Pixar for quite a long time now. But in a lot of ways, Pixar's their own thing, because it's not like Disney's other animated movies are that Pixar-ish. It's almost like they have their own thing, and Disney lets them be that under their banner. And there are other forms of animation. We mentioned DreamWorks. They've had animated movies that have been successful, like the Shrek series and many other ones.
They haven't aged nearly as well as, say, the Toy Story series has.
That's true. And animation, as you just said, is more for kids. It's funny that way. Almost always, if there's a big animated hit coming out that year, and there probably always is at least one or two or ten, often that's been the biggest hit of the year. Toy Story 3 was. I think Toy Story, the first one in 1995, was the number one hit of that year.
But did it truly have to be that way? Do you ever think, was it just the influence of early animation filmmakers that decided that that was the market that they wanted to pursue?
It's probably true. It's like we see the same basic arc in most movies. We talked about this on Being John Malkovich last year, that even though that's such an unusual and weird story, and Cameron Diaz said that there are something like 11 stories in Hollywood and this is the 12th, well, as much as that movie is so creative and original and cool and funny and all those things, it still is a love triangle in the end, which is one of the 11 stories that have been made over and over and over. It's the same thing with animated films. You're right. Why does it have to be that it's for kids? It isn't always. Granted, there have been some really harsh movies. Waltz with Bashir is a great example of that. It's a war movie with animation. Persepolis is another one that's not at all for kids. I Lost My Body from last year, which I think is still on Netflix. An Oscar nominee is not really a kids movie per se. There are plenty that you could say that about. But the ones that really succeed, Yeah, they fit the kid genre for sure.
It's just a license to print money. It's an absolute endless supply of capital because kids never get sick of watching them. And because there's always new generations of kids. You know, we watched Pinocchio growing up. My family really loved Dumbo. We watched that one over and over again. And those movies, when I was growing up, were already 40 years old. So it's this never-ending market. Kids don't need novel. Well, everything's novel to children, so they can watch them over and over again. And listen, Disney was an incredible innovator, obviously a person who respected the art of animation, but he was also a pretty phenomenal businessman as well, and he knew how to capitalize on this. It's no accident that his company that he founded is now the probably biggest entertainment company in history. I'm not sure. I could be wrong about that because I'm not that familiar with Asian entertainment companies. I know they have a much bigger market, but Disney, good lord.
I don't think they're bigger than Disney. I don't think there's anything else in Hollywood that comes close. Because Disney's got, in addition to stuff that they already had and stuff that they would have the rights to, like this, that they could re-release. No way they could re-release. But they've got Pixar, they've got Star Wars, they've got Marvel, they've got Fox
Nat, now Nat Geo.
Banner.
They have Nat Geo, right?
Right, but you just stepped over me saying they've got Fox under the banner. So that all happens because of things like Pinocchio and Snow White way back when, being so good and being beloved for all these decades since. Now, we just mentioned Dumbo. That was remade last year in a live-action film, and there have been live-action versions of this. There's a lot of connections, actually, to other films with Pinocchio, not surprisingly. Roberto Benigni did a live-action one in 2002, which just tanked. And he went from being the beloved boy of Hollywood,
the golden boy of
Life is Beautiful, to being hated in, I think, the next movie he made, and certainly one of the next movies he made. And I don't think he's done much since.
Has anyone overstayed their welcome quicker than Roberto Benigni?
And one of the worst choices for best actor, I think, in retrospect. Good performance, but not Oscar-worthy in retrospect. Adventures of Pinocchio was in 1996. I don't think I've ever seen that. And there's an Italian live-action film just last year. Guaranteed you there will be some kind of remake, like Lion King and Aladdin.
Well, they're trying to do it. So they cast Hanks as Geppetto. Tom Hanks as Geppetto. I want to say it was Sam Mendes was attached to direct, and then he walked away, and then they were kind of getting something off the ground, and Zemeckis' name was getting thrown around, but then Dumbo failed.
They'll do Little Mermaid, and they will do Pinocchio. It may have stalled. They'll do Pinocchio, I guarantee you.
The newer Disney classics have performed really well in their remakes, but the older Disney classics, Dumbo, have not.
Cinderella
so
did well a couple
years
ago.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Dumbo is a total downer. I can't believe I loved it when I was a kid because I'm so sensitive about animal suffering in films.
The most famous moment in that movie is about an animal suffering.
Yeah.
The mother being encaged and trying to comfort her kid.
God, those old Disney films really didn't go easy on the kids. And they didn't lay it on thick with the plot either. It's something that you really notice when you go back and watch these old Disney films from the 30s and 40s. The plots are very thin, and there's a lot of padding with these fun and creative sequences. We talk so much about all the clocks. That goes on for minutes of us just watching clocks. Just this parade of creative, fun animation, and it's delightful. Snow White, I think, does it even more. There's so many sequences of just the dwarves being goofy and fun.
Bathing.
Yeah, exactly. And it serves no purpose except to just be fun to watch. When I was a kid, I loved it. I could watch this stuff over and over again. And the plot could be pared down to a tight 25 minutes if you wanted to cut out all these scenes. But I think they understood that kids have a lot more patience for that kind of stuff than we think they do. But it's something they've really phased out in more modern films. And I find kids' films now are almost too plot heavy. They have too much going on.
Well, we hacked on the whole thing about Geppetto just sending Pinocchio off to school on his own. But we'd be hacking right now if they dwelled on it too much, about him thinking about it and planning it and executing it.
Or if there was a whole B story where we got to see Geppetto searching for him. We just learned from a letter from the Blue Fairy instead of including that plot. But they are making time so that Pinocchio and Jiminy Cricket can just walk on the ocean floor and have all these wacky, beautiful adventures in the water. Oh, and speaking of the water, one of the great innovations of Pinocchio was the style, what they call effects animation, which is things like scenery, vehicles, weather, and water. And I say water specifically because this was particularly special in this movie. It was designed by an influential abstract animator named Oscar Fischinger, who spent a whole year just creating the water effects, which granted are a big part of the film. But this is what I talk about with Disney's innovation. He had the vision to give artists time and resources to truly create something new. There's also something about the way, I couldn't even begin to describe how they do it, but the way that they show perspective in this film,
yeah.
It almost looks like computer animation with the smoothness of it and the way it creates real depth when the camera moves. But of course, it's not a camera, it's an animated set, so to speak. And it was absolutely one of a kind when the film was made.
They spent a lot of time in production on this because Disney had the resources. Like you said, he'd made all of those shorts and successful. And then Snow White was so successful that he could take his time. I think I read somewhere that during his Oscar acceptance speech for Snow White, I believe he was promoting Pinocchio then. And yet Fantasia, I believe, beat it to the punch. This came out at least a year after it was supposed to. But when you've got the resources he had, you don't need to rush it. Unlike now where it's, well, we've got a release date. There's a big movie coming out in 2021 or 2022 that's on June this or July that, that's booked right now, and they haven't even got a cast or a script. I can't even think of an example of that right now, but something big is going to come out on one of those days. But they got to meet that deadline versus, no, the movie's not ready. And Walt was of the opinion way back when, as other filmmakers may have been too, you get the movie out when it's ready.
Recently, we've had two amazing examples of opposite takes on that. One, you have Cats, which famously came out when it wasn't finished because they were trying to rush awards season or whatever it was. They decided to release it when it wasn't finished, and it bombed in the theaters and is considered one of the worst films to come out maybe this century. Then you have another great example, which is the Sonic film, which was about to get a release, and then the fans freaked out about the way it looked. They took 6 whole months to redo it.
And now as we talk about this, it was a giant hit this past weekend.
Yeah, you were just telling me. So that was obviously the right plan. Now, I understand award season can gum that up. Release dates in general, they plan them so far in advance because they don't want to compete with other release dates, blah, blah, blah. There's just so much that goes into this marketing. Bambi was supposed to come out before Pinocchio. But they had to go back.
Maybe that's what they were talking about.
Yeah, they weren't happy with the animation. They failed to accurately show how animals move, so they decided to go back and just work harder and make it perfect. These films are amazing, but I imagine it would have been very frustrating to work for Walt Disney because number of times his artists would have just been told to scrap all of their work and then go back to the drawing board and do it better this time.
Literally.
Oh my God, yeah, literally the drawing board.
Maybe it was Bambi then he promoted on the Snow White night at the Oscars. It could have been that. And that even after
Pinocchio took Bambi's release date because it was just done sooner.
So I talked about connections. There's more of them. I mentioned Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which is a lot of Pinocchio themes, including hearing John Williams play When You Wish Upon a Star, just as a musical theme. It's not blatantly obvious, but you know that's what it is. And AI as well. When David, the robot who wants to be a real boy, the movie should have ended with him staring at the blue fairy under the water. It is a blue fairy he's looking at. He thinks it is, at least. And then, make me a real boy. Make me a real boy. Rather than the coda. The coda's got some good things in it, if you think about AI. I think AI is a excellent film that could have been a brilliant film if it just ended the right note.
It's
and
so
to me,
close.
The right note is, have it be that he is staring, and he's a robot, so this goes on for a long time, many years, staring at her, just saying the same thing over and over until eventually his power source wears down, and that's his tragic ending.
Because it is still a tragic ending. Right. It's a bizarre tragic ending. But you're right, there's enough good things about AI to make you forgive its shortcomings and appreciate it for what it's got. God, I would have loved to see what Kubrick would have done with that film.
Well, it was supposed to be Kubrick's film, yeah.
Yeah,
Kubrick
yeah.
took it over.
A tremendous amount of references to Pinocchio. It had been so long since I've seen Pinocchio, so while I was watching it this time around, I kept saying, oh, AI was pulling directly from this. It's very nakedly almost remaking Pinocchio inside the framework of their own story.
Also, There Are No Strings on Me, which is set in Age of Ultron, the Avengers sequel. Liar, Liar, which isn't really connected to Pinocchio, but it's all about how he can't lie. He's not able to. In this movie, of course, the puppet grows a big nose in the process. That only happens, I think, one time.
Yeah, right? I thought it was such a way bigger part of the film, and I was surprised that it's really just one scene.
And it grows a nest, even.
Yeah, it's pretty
with birds
cute.
In it.
But it's a great, cute example of the way that they use creativity. It's just beautiful.
And the last connection from a recent movie we covered, which was Spotlight. I know that would sound weird, but the connection is that kids are put in serious danger by leering old men in both movies. Last thoughts on the 1940 animated classic Pinocchio.
Well, I feel like I gave it a really hard time because it's pretty fun to rip apart the morality of it. And I actually do genuinely question the morality of it. If I had kids, I would not encourage them to watch this movie. But if you're a fan of animation, it deserves its status as a absolute classic. The creativity and the beauty of the artwork in this film is pretty hard to match.
I do love it, maybe because it's so surreal and weird and even a bit terrifying, especially for youngsters. And I can see why Terry Gilliam, of all people, loves this movie.
Oh, absolutely.
Very fitting that he would, because he's also weird and a bit terrifying in a lot of his pictures. Okay, that's it for Pinocchio. In 7 days, it will be March 9th, and that's exactly 1 month since Parasite pulled off a huge upset at the Oscars, so let's talk about Parasite.
Yay!
Months earlier than we've talked about the other Best Picture winners. We've covered Moonlight, Shape of Water, and Green Book later in the year that they won the Oscars. Well, now we'll do this one only a month later. Why not? We bought the Blu-ray, and it needs to be watched and discussed.
Thank God we get to talk about this and not The Irishman.
That was never going to win.
No, that was never going to win.
The coming attractions trivia for Parasite. Of the directors who won three, or arguably four, with Bong Joon-ho that night, or is it Pong? I think it might be Pong.
I think it's pronounced Pong.
Okay. They won that many Oscars in one night. So three at least, or arguably four. How many of those guys were nominated for the first time ever in any category that night?
Okay. So for the answer to that question, please check out next week's podcast about Parasite. And in the meantime, you can check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to favorite or subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify, where hundreds of episodes are available for free. And that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 list of the best American films ever made, and many, many more titles. While you're there, rate us, review us. It's a good deed that will go towards making you a real boy, I promise. If you would like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I'm at BevEllisEllis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51, or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you in Canada or the US, please go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code TOP100PROJECT, and that's all one word, TOP100PROJECT, and it's not case sensitive, for a 20% discount.
When you wish upon a cut.
And cut.